Welcome to the IP 360 podcast, brought to you by IP Private Wealth. This podcast talks about wealth, health, and all the different ways we measure our success. It's a true 360-degree look at how we manage our wealth. We're here today with Richard Kluska, CEO of IP Private Wealth, and Habib Saikli, CIO of IP Private Wealth. I'll be handing the interview reins over to Richard today for a candid chat with Habib about prudent and cohesive investing 101. Richard and Habib, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So in my life, I've got someone who is a business owner, and they're at the point where they're looking at retirement succession planning. And they've had that fragmented advisor experience this whole time. And they haven't really had a chance, because of course they're busy on their business, to learn anything about how investments actually work. They just kind of, they get advice from their accountant and they don't really understand what's happening. Is that a common thing that you see when people first engage with IP Private Wealth?
Yeah, many clients would come to us with questions, because what they're doing by dealing with multiple advisors is they're getting multiple storylines. And so they're trying to reconcile and come to sort of a conclusion as to what to do. So ideally, you know, at IP Private Wealth, most of our clients have 100% a wallet with us. So they're getting consistent, stable advice, you know, that'll help them achieve their goals. You know, to deal with multiple investment advisors, you're dealing with multiple personalities, and they may or may not have addressed the individual's needs and wants. The dealing with multiple advisors, you're getting, you know, multiple salesmen selling product. And at IP Private Wealth, we're not selling a product. We're providing a very valuable service. And that's called wealth management for the client now and for the, you know, their family members down the road.
Habib, a lot of clients come to us and they've had previous relationships with advisors, and all the advisors always promise the same thing, which is they're going to be able to capture all of the upside and to limit the downside. They're not going to take the downside. They're going to get effective market timing and pick up all the upside, no downside. Experience indicates that has not happened. So why is the IP Private Wealth portfolio different?
Well, many, again, depending on the type of advisor people are dealing with, some advisors tend to be focused on, you know, one particular asset class. So they might be just focused on, you know, equities or preferred shares or whatever the case may be, whatever they think they can generate the most revenue for themselves. Where in our case, we're providing a, you know, a prudent and cohesive constructed portfolio that involves risk management concepts and processes that, mitigate, you know, downside. Yes, we're not going to capture, you know, 100% of the upside. And when I say 100% of the upside, I meant of the equity upside, because that's, people think if they're invested in the market, they're only invested in equities. Well, that's not how we operate, because bottom line is we have, you know, five different asset classes that we invest in, so that the client's investment experience is over the long term, is a more stable one, and not a roller coaster ride by focusing on just on a volatile asset class like equities. Because in the end, you want some liquidity, and you want some income, and you want some capital growth, and we provide that by the way we invest.
So on that topic, Habib, like, we utilize an alternative investment, which right now there's a lot of discussion of alternatives because fixed income is so low. They're talking about liquid alternatives. Just to maybe give our clients some sense, what actually is an alternative investment, and how is our alternative fund provide value to our clients?
Well, when people talk alternative investments, it's like 10 years ago, they were talking about hedge funds. So if it wasn't a traditional mutual fund and, you know, it did some, you know, the strategy, the underlying strategy was something risky or whatever, they just called it a hedge fund. And that's an oxymoron, because when you talk about hedge, you're protecting something. You're hedging your bets, or you're hedging some downside. So hedge funds were used loosely. Alternative funds in today's world is also being used loosely. But what we do is we focus on what we call a pure alternative strategy, which is, you know, we can define what the strategy is in this in this marketplace. So when we talk about alternatives, you know, it's an alternative to what asset class? And so in our case, we're looking at an alternative to the fixed income asset class, because bonds, as you said, interest rates are so low that investors, traditional balanced investors that have 40%, you know, in fixed income and 60% in equities, are not going to yield much return on their fixed income portfolio. So if you have 40% of your investments yielding 1%, that's only 0.4 at the end of the year of return from that asset class. Whereas we focus on alternative lending strategies in our pool. And so we have, you know, mortgages, we have accounts receivable lending, we have commercial paper-backed lending, and we have midterm lending strategies in our portfolio. And the benefits there is you get better yield. So the current yield roughly in most alternatives is north of 6%. So in the end, if you really want to generate some income and you don't have a liquidity need immediately, then these alternative strategies will definitely reward you over the longer term versus fixed income investments right now, because we know that with fixed income investments right now, with rates so low, you run the risk of losing principal as rates start to rise. And in this case, alternative strategies are, you know, you've given up market risk, you've taken on some business and liquidity risk, but you're being compensated for that, you know, when you compare what you're getting out in the fixed income marketplace for owning a corporate bond. So, you know, alternative income strategies is not for everyone, but it meets our clients' needs, because with high net worth clients, they have the fortitude to withstand some temporary market impact, and that they don't need to tap into that asset class right away. That'll be a steady income generator for them over the longer term, while their equities, you know, pay their dividends and grow at a prudent and modest rate over time. So alternatives. Be careful when people are talking alternatives. You have to truly understand what the underlying strategy is and what objective you're trying to accomplish with that.
So again, just on the alternatives here, Habib, you know, the alternative investment class is similar to a bond, and that's in its underwriting credit and underwriting credit risk. However, I know in our discussions is there is one risk that nobody really speaks of, which is liquidity risk, right? There's some liquidity constraints on a true alternative. And the market has been trying to create these liquid alternatives, which I always consider an oxymoron as well. But maybe you can express again, what is the liquidity risk of an alternative? What is the what are the things that a client should be aware of? As you said, it's not for everybody. What are some of the things an investor should be aware of?
Well, they with respect to the true alternative income strategy that we focus on, they have to understand that these aren't daily liquid investments like a money market instrument or a government or corporate bond where you can trade, you know, daily and liquidate and get your money back. What we're doing is basically investing in a pool of loans, whether they're factoring loans or asset backed loans or you know, midterm loans or mortgages. You just can't liquidate those immediately. So clients have to understand that, when you're putting your money into these funds, think of it as being in you're putting money into a GIC that's locked up for a period of time. That if you try to take your money out, the bank's going to penalize you. And in this case, we're not talking about penalizing clients, but bottom line is when you're putting your money into these alternative funds, you have to think of it as money being locked up for a period of time, and that you have to ensure that you have the means or other sources of cash flow should the moment prevail that you need extra cash. But again, alternatives are meant for a longer term investment horizon and the willingness to be patient about investing in these types of strategies.
So if I understand this correctly, is that the alternatives offer a substantive increase over the risk-free rate that's consistent. Liquidity is probably one of the main sources of risk, or lack of liquidity, reduced liquidity, but therefore a proper asset allocation is key to developing this kind of investment portfolio, correct?
Absolutely. You don't want all your eggs in one basket, as the old proverb goes. But, you know, when you focus, when you're, you know, again, these alternative strategies don't have market risk. They have, as you said, liquidity risk. And there's also underlying business risk because, you know, the managers of these alternative funds are lending money to small and medium-sized businesses at a premium. So investors get compensated for the liquidity risk and the business risk by way of a premium that's being posted on these loans. So, you know, are they guaranteed? No. You know, is there a risk to them? Yeah, but when you're spread across hundreds of loans and one or two of them default, you know, your underlying yield may drop a bit, but you're not taking on material risk by being diversified that way. So in the end, you get compensated for liquidity and business risk by the fact that all these private lenders are lending at levels that are far greater than what the current interest rate environments are.
So it'll be on that same sort of flow here a bit. There's, as you know, when it comes, we go back to equities for a moment. There's a lot of different ways of investing in the equity market, whether you want to have a total growth strategy, momentum strategy, or we espouse the benefit of a dividend and earnings growth strategy. Can you explain to our listeners why this is a key benefit in anybody's portfolio?
Again, it's all a function of your investment time horizon. So if you're young, aggressive, and love to day trade, dividend earnings growth, you know, isn't a strategy that would appeal to you. Our strategy appeals to the private client, to the high net worth individual who's made their money, you know, in their profession or in their business, and are successful enough to say, hey, you know what? I don't need to hit a home run anymore because I hit my home run in my practice and my business. I just need, you know, a stable, steady investment strategy. And dividend growth strategies empirically over a longer period of times have been shown that they outperform. There's going to be periods of times where the strategy will underperform because that's the nature of markets. You know, markets go through various sentimental changes over any cycle. You know, this year in 2020 with COVID, at the beginning of the year, dividend value strategy actually looked very good relative to the market. But by the end of the year, it was a strategy that sort of lagged because momentum and high growth oriented strategies outperformed. But again, that's a short-term window. Over the long term, because the market ends up rewarding companies that actually make money and reward their investors by paying dividends. So
sorry to interject for a second, just a question, because when I watch CNBC or any of these talk shows on the financial channels, the indication is there is someone out there who can time this market perfectly. Thoughts?
Let's hire them.
So have you ever seen one work in the long run?
You'll have managers perform well in the short term, you know, 1 to 3 year window that look like stars. And then, and then if they're playing the momentum growth game, you know, in this environment, you know, they're looking like stars. But at some point, those strategies sort of fade off because economic realities kick in. Because everyone, you know, you might be paying, you know, 100 times earnings for a company because the expectations that, you know, their earnings will catch up with where their valuation should be. But then earnings don't catch up and those companies get hammered quickly and the stock prices drop precipitously back to sort of more normal levels. For example, GoPro 5 years ago was at close to $100. It's trading around $8 now because everyone thought that, you know, GoPros were the next best thing to slice bread. So you have to be careful when you're investing. Again, it's your, you know, if you have a long-term time horizon, you don't need to play these momentum games. If you're a day trader slash gambler and you need that daily fix of adrenaline, you know, go for it, you know, but there will, you know, and don't forget, investors talk about their winners. They never talk about their losers. So bottom line is for our clients who have made it, who've had enough stress and challenges in their life growing their businesses, and then, you know, they want to reap the benefits thereafter. They just want a portfolio that can allow them to cruise through any rough waters and they don't want a roller coaster ride.
So it'd be on that whole discussion here about management and active management. So as you know, the market really has two different camps, right? You have the active manager, which everybody thinks of a Warren Buffett or someone like that. And then you have the camp of passive management where no, you just want to be the market. You don't want to be actively managing. And now with the introduction of Tesla in the S&P 500, what are your comments on passive investing and what does Tesla mean to someone buying the S&P 500?
Well, passive investing has its place, right? Those are for the large institutions, large pension funds that want a low cost exposure to investing in the stock market. Active management also has its place because bottom line is passive management won't function without active management because you need price discovery to determine what a stock is worth. And that happens every day in the stock market because it's a daily auction. So you need active management to truly determine what the value of a stock is and what the value of the stock market is. If you didn't have active management, you'd pretty much have a private market and it would be a private equity market and everyone would just be determining, you know, what a company might be worth based on, you know, what their spreadsheet's telling them they're willing to pay for a company. So the public markets, the stock markets, is a place of price discovery on a daily basis. And at sometimes in the market cycle, you know, prices are elevated and at other times prices are deflated, but over the long term, the stock markets find their equilibrium. And there's points in time where active managers will outperform passive strategies because they might have that edge in terms of how their strategy is behaving. But we know that certain strategies do well over the long term and others don't. And empirical, like I said, empirical research has shown that dividend growth strategies have performed well over the long term with lower volatility.
So on this whole topic of passive, as a sidebar, I know there's more now passive indexes than there are stocks in the stock market, which is interesting. But having said that, passive investing is a relative benchmark. And now there's a whole arena heading into goal-based investing. Can you explain to our clients the difference between the two?
If you're a relative-based investor, you're basically, you know, someone who wants to think that you're smarter than the market. You're trying to outperform what millions of participants are doing every day. So if the stock market does 10% and you've done 12%, you're patting yourself on the back. If the stock market's done 10% and you've done 7%, you're kicking yourself wondering why didn't I buy the index? Cause I would have done better. So the relative investor, performance-based investor is really just focusing on, do they feel they're smarter than the marketplace? A goal-based investor is really, the meaning of goal-based investing is in the term itself. You're trying to you set goals and you want to achieve them. So when we put financial plans together for clients, we determine what return is needed for them to achieve their goals and how much do they have to contribute, you know, to help meet their goals. Because we can't just do it all on performance. You know, there has to be this is a joint venture between the client and ourselves. We'll get them, you know, the returns that, based on the cash flows that they can provide. We'll get them the returns to get to the finish line. And so if you're goal-based, you're focused on really being able to meet your long-term plans and your long-term goals based on the financial plan that that's been set out. And so in the end, you don't have to stress out about beating the market or doing better than the market or being 100% invested in high-risk stocks, because that's the only way you're going to ever be able to catch up and meet your retirement goals. No, the thing is, those, you know, that, you know, if that's the case, then, you know, we can't help people like that. Bottom line is, we're here to help people who can work with a plan, you know, have a particular goal or many goals that they want to achieve. And then we can focus on getting the returns that'll help them achieve their goals, and not getting the returns that'll, you know, beat a passive index or, you know, a market index.
So on that point, I know when we do our strategic financial planning, we establish certain parameters for them to have peace of mind and to achieve all their financial goals. And that's usually measured by a return above inflation after tax, correct? So correct. The issue is, I know I'm going to go and answer one part, which is the dividend growth. When you can pick up 4%+ yield on your portfolio just on the income plus prudent growth, that's a much smoother ride than just high growth where you're up 20 minus 30, up 40 minus 50. That asymmetrical return pattern can be very painful. However, the one thing I just want to focus on today is the after tax. So again, the market promoters have these things called corporate class mutual funds that promise that all taxation on the income and the growth of the mutual funds will not be attributable to tax on non-registered accounts. Can you explain your history? Because in your history, you dealt with analysis on this. Can you explain in your history what the corporate class mutual fund can or cannot do for you?
In the world of comparing mutual funds to mutual funds, corporate class can save you a bit of tax, relatively speaking. However, when you're talking about private client investing versus corporate class, there's a huge difference, because yeah, the corporate class might have some tax deferral benefit, but the fees on these corporate class structures far outweigh the benefits in the end. Because you got to remember, you're paying tax on the income that you earn versus paying fees on your entire asset base. So the fees on the entire asset base might ends up eating into the income that you would have earned. And therefore, you know, are you truly better off? Because, you know, you're going to end up paying the piper eventually. You got to pay CRA at some point. But the thing is, though, you're also paying the fund company a premium to help you minimize taxes. But in the end, on a total after tax, after cost basis, you might not necessarily be better off.
Is it also not true that CRA has changed some of the rules of these corporate class funds?
Yeah, there used to be the switching capabilities where you can switch from one fund to the another fund within the family and not trigger capital gains. My understanding is that that's been eliminated. So bottom line is some of that incremental benefits of corporate class have been eroded. And it's no different than a number of years ago where they eliminated the capital yield structure, where basically, you know, funds were introduced where they were using futures and forward contracts to convert income into capital gains. And so it would be masking the nature of the income, you know, for tax benefits. And that got eliminated. And those funds don't exist anymore, because bottom line is CRA isn't in the business of giving everyone a free lunch. You know, the government needs to get paid at some point so that they can fulfill their obligation to its citizens. But at the same time, as a individual living in Canada or anywhere where there's a tax regime, you know, you know, it's always nice to, you know, to pay your taxes, but you don't have to leave them a tip. So, but bottom line is corporate class isn't really saving people much of anything nowadays. And it's actually probably more costly because you do pay a premium in the management fees. And most people think they don't pay management fees because it's embedded into the net returns of the mutual fund. So it's sort of a hidden cost.
Okay. So what you're saying there, Habib, is what I just heard is a corporate class mutual fund is a deferral mechanism at a very high cost. That's correct. That's what I heard. Okay. So on tax strategies, I know we work quite diligently with the client's accountants and tax counsel to make sure that we mitigate tax where possible and where prudent without affecting huge costs. So we introduce things like individual pension plans, RCAs possibly. There's also the use of asset location strategies to minimize current taxation, long-term taxation, and U.S. estate tax, which is coming back to bear this year with the Biden election. Can you spend just a minute on what an asset location strategy is?
Yeah, in simple terms, it's really just allocating your investable assets based on what you have and to the most tax efficient way. So if the bulk of your assets are in your registered accounts, well, effectively, what you want is you want your most taxed level of income in your RSP. So for example, fixed income or alternative fixed income in your RSPs. And outside of your RSPs or not our registered accounts, you want assets that have got the most the least punitive tax implication on your income or capital gains. So bottom line is, ideally, you want to set up your investment strategy such that the most taxed source of income is in your registered accounts, and the least taxed income or capital gains in your non-registered accounts. And again, it'll vary from client to client because it depends on where the bulk of their net worth is. So, but at some point, when you become very wealthy, tax minimization strategies, tend to be far and fewer between.
Yeah, and that's where the structure with the accountants and tax counsel of trusts and various strategies to defer the tax as far as possible. Because ultimately, like you said before in corporate class, taxes will have to be paid. You're trying to mitigate that. You're trying to defer that where possible. And like you say, don't leave a tip to either CRA or to a fund managers on fees. So, and correct. One last question, Habib, I have is, I've been investing, you've been investing for some time now, and I remember 2000, and I remember 2008, and where after 2009, the market had a great return, but after a period of 7-8 years, people are still zero on total growth because of this thing called an asymmetrical return pattern. Can you just spend just a minute or two talking about what the real barrier to compound return is?
With respect to, asymmetrical returns, to put it simply, if you own $1,000 worth of investments and it dropped down to $500, right? So you're down 50%. Well, what do your investments have to do to get back to, $1,000? So your $1,000 went to $500. It has to pretty much, so that's down 50%. So in order to get back to 1,000, it has to grow by 100% because your 500 now has to double to get back to even. So asymmetrical returns is a concept that you should be very focused on, because the last thing you want to do, especially if you're focusing on the long term and you're more of a speculator than an investor. If you're investing in high risk securities and they go down, what do you have to do to get back to break even? And a lot of people try to double down and chase it and hope that it comes back, and that's painful. And you end up costing yourselves more in the long run by experiencing this type of volatility in your portfolio. So the whole idea is to avoid that type of return pattern, because like I said, if you're down 50%, you got to earn 100% just to get back to break even.
Thanks, Habib. And you know what? I think we've, thanks for all this. And at some another podcast, we'll have to talk about behavioral finance and how psychology oftentimes have an impact on good old fashioned portfolio management. So thanks for that. And thanks again.
My pleasure.
Thanks to both Richard and Habib. This has been a great episode. Looking forward to listening to it a few times over to make sure I catch everything that Habib shared with us. Such wisdom. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now for the fine print. The opinions and statements expressed by our team are effective as of the date of this broadcast and may be subject to change.